But today is VE Day. The war is
the
over.
The crowned queen waves from the balcony.
Eagle has landed. Apollo 11 has landed.
Tearing down the Berlin Wall.
Since 1929, the Monks Investment Trust's mission has been to help investors grow their wealth. We aim to do this today by taking a three-dimensional approach to growth. Cyclical growth, rapid growth, and steady growth.
The worldwide web.
Wall Street is in turmoil as stocks crash.
The Monks Investment Trust, managed by Bailey Gifford. Capital at risk.
Hello and welcome to The Wealth Show, where we discuss the themes shaping portfolios and the wealth management industry more widely. I'm joined in the studio by Saka Nasabian, who is Chief Executive Officer of Federated Hermes Limited, which is the non-US arm and stewardship business of the global asset manager. Saka, welcome to the studio.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start talking about ESG, which is a big thing for Federated Hermes. You say ESG is about risk management, not ideology. That seems quite different to the general perception.
Yes, and this has been the case since the start of the firm. Before we started, I was telling about the background of the firm and how Ralph Katana started.
Yeah.
We noticed that if you do things in a certain way and you're a long-term investor, it enhances return. I'll give you the best example of that. Which is somebody else who came after Ralph Katana. The third, not the second, but the third CEO, I think, was a man called Alistair Ross Scoopy. So a bit of background about me. I came to university. I went to university in London in 1979. And I had a dog and I was an idiot. And I did not realize that people do not let you stay in their houses as a student with a dog and a student.
I see.
So the only place I could live was a slum called King's Cross.
Which is no longer a slum, we should say.
Which is about the time that actually Alistair Ross Scoopy, on behalf of the BT pension scheme, was looking to invest in it and using Argent as the developer. And the idea they came up with sounded completely non-capitalist, non-financial, which is, let's develop this inner city slum, 60 acres. Let us actually consult the people who live in the estates around about what they want. Let's work closely with the council, who at the time was a very left-wing council, and let us give back to the community as we build this. So as the development progressed, what did they do? They gave the largest square to London since Trafalgar Square, Granary Square. They gave the Keystone building to a university, St. Martin's. They built a school for disabled children for free and gave it to them.
Yeah.
They built a swimming pool for the people who live in the estates. They gave back. They built affordable housing. All of this was ahead of time.
And I suppose, I imagine they made a lot of money for the BT pension scheme in the long run.
And the question is why? Because when you had the American tech companies that we talked about in the previous section come to look towards set up their headquarters in London, what they saw was a community, not a concrete jungle. And so the returns have been very high, well over mid-teens, well over 15% over the life of the project after all fees.
Yeah.
And after all costs, which is an outstanding return. And that proves to us, if you like, that in the long term, if you integrate what we call sustainability, it's not just a risk mitigant, it's actually an opportunity. It creates upside as well, if you are long term. Now, what happened was in the 2018s or so, it became trendy, 15, 16. I hate being trendy. I mean, as you see, I'm wearing a suit when the whole of London is in T-shirts because I've been born a contrarian and I like being one. But I was. I think the FT once called me a hippie. Now, I'm too young to be a hippie. I'm only 65. My brother was a hippie and my sister was a hippie. So I was brought up by hippies, but I'm not one. But it's a misunderstanding of what integrating sustainability is about. It's about enhancing long-term returns. Long-term is the only differentiator. If you're going to be a trader, it doesn't work. But if you want to be an investor, we know it works. We have the data going all the way back to 1983.
Yeah.
That's why we integrated.
Okay. Well, so some of the background we're talking about here. So in the 2010s, ESG equities, I mean, we can discuss whether that's a sensible thing to refer to, performed very well, right, as part of a general trend of growth
yes.
equities
yeah.
performing well. For the last few years, it hasn't worked
yes.
so well. So has something changed there?
No, I think a lot of what's called ESG were not ESG, they were SRI, social responsible investment. It's about sort of exclusions is the heart of it. What's the point of exclusions? You want to change something. You want, you know, you have to understand if you own a company and you want it to improve, you've got to engage with the company, right? You've got to decide why you want to improve. I mean, you're not doing this just for the sake. I mean, there is a moral element. Now, back in the 1990s, there was an SRI business which made perfect sense. The Quakers are brilliant. I mean, I'm a great admirer of them. And the Quakers have money that, and the Methodists that does not invest in defense, as an example. That's a religious thing. Sharia funds, as an example, do not invest in defense or in...
So these are hard ethical lines.
Hard ethical lines. But if you're an investor, why are you integrating sustainability? Because it makes sense for the business in the long term. Let's talk about diversity in this country, and let's talk about diversity in London. From a purely Miltonian Chicago School economics point of view, my job as a CEO, when it comes to cost, is to buy labor at the lowest, cheapest unit labor cost I can. Why do I want to cut my supply line by half? It just doesn't make sense. My target audience, the people who've been listening to this, are 50% female. Why do I want to cut my target audience by not listening to them? That's just stupid. So my argument is if you don't think about equality, then actually you're financially illiterate. In London, where we have 365 languages, why wouldn't I access this? If I hire everybody who's smart from Oxford, not just because I failed to get an Oxford, but if I hire everybody from Oxford or from Harvard or from Princeton, and they all went to the same MBA, and they all read the same thing, and they all live in the same place, I'm going to get the same outcome when they think about it. But if I hire people from outside of that who went to a comprehensive school or went to a different university or who come from a different country, then you have people who can see outside of that. By the way, that's a song of Pete Seeger's Little Boxes. But anyway, so you need people from outside to be able to see. So all of this makes sense. Every bit of sustainability makes sense as an investment, either as a risk mitigant, but more importantly, as an opportunity. But the key, again, I go back to it over and over again, provided you're investing for the long term. What happened in the time that you're talking about is it became very trendy. Everybody got very excited about it. It became the ESG investment thing, right? Like there's the world here and then there's the ESG world. What does that mean? Doesn't make sense. And it was given impetus by the worry about global warming. That became the banner for doing it, which is right. But it was distorted. It basically conflated socially responsible investing with sustainable investing. They're not the same thing. Socially responsible investing is ethical investing. That's good. But I'm an agent. I cannot force on you my ethics. So you tell me what you want. You know, you're a Quaker, tell me. You're a Sharia guy, tell me. You're whatever it is, tell me. What I can say to you is if I use all these things out here, I will, in the long term, make you more money. That's what sustainable investment is about.
Okay. So you think a lot of the underperformance of sustainable funds or the sustainable funds universe is because of this confusion with SRI.
I believe so.
So they will have just said no oil stocks,
basically,
that kind of thing.
Yes. So I mean, just, I know we've flogged the horse. Let's flog a bit more. So, okay, we need to do this because if I'm saving money and I'm going to retire, then not controlling global warming is going to result in massive flood risk, massive, I think, the social disruption risk and massive immigration risk. All of these things are now well known. Okay, so how do I influence my outcome as an investor? I have two options. Number one, I refuse to buy any shares in any oil company. Does that make any difference to oil companies?
Not no. immediately.
Not even in the long term. They're not in the stock market. Does not
but
provide.
But maybe not capital. Lending to them would.
That's a different thing. But that's exclusion in lending, not exclusion in shares. But if I were to actually sit with them and say, okay, I'm your owner. So you have to listen to me as an owner of your business. And your business is going to become less about oil and then eventually more about gas and then eventually more about alternative powers. What are you doing to mitigate the risk to your business? How can I help you transfer to this other kind of directionality? Then I can influence the outcomes.
Okay.
And that's the difference.
So you clearly think there's a lot of confused thinking out there about this topic. I mean, what do you, so we do have sustainable fund frameworks. We have one in the UK now,
yeah.
You know, SDR is one in the EU, which has been running a bit longer, SFDR. I won't pretend I remember exactly what it stands for now. Do you think these frameworks are fit for purpose? Do you think they're working well?
So I'm an immigrant back in the old country when I grew up. My mom would always say to me, whenever we talked about other people, all people are a blessing and are good. And I've learned in life that that's my attitude to other things. So all frameworks are a blessing and are good because that's what people want. That's what the buyers want.
Okay.
I understand that. In my view, does it conflate investment? I think it does. I think it downgrades the centrality of sustainability to the long term. But I can't dictate on clients what they want, right?
Okay.
And ultimately, this is driven by clients in Europe primarily who want to make a difference. Now, this is an ethical thing, right? They want to make a difference. And that creates that framework. Therefore, the framework is correct because it tells clients what they're buying. So there's the academic bit about how's the investment going. And the other one is, are we making sure that we're protecting the consumer so they work?
Yeah. A final word on this topic. Sustainable and Article 8 funds have increasingly been investing in defence stocks. That's definitely a trend. You've mentioned it already in terms of, you know, ethical exclusions or whether that's the right way to go or not. But is that a move that you agree with?
The short answer is yes. There was a meeting between a lot of people who are basically prime thinkers in the sustainable space. This was not last year. This was the year before because of the Ukraine war. They needed somebody from England, so they sort of kindly asked me to come and join them on a Zoom call. And that was a discussion. And the argument that not myself, but all of us agreed to, and there were some big academic names, that is, look, sustainable means it's sustained, right? So let us assume there's an enemy, or whoever the enemy is, Russia might be one, who's coming into your country. If you can't stop them, then the entire economy is not sustained.
We're not going to live in a world without defence companies. Yeah, you're not that big a hippie, yeah? Okay. So moving on, SpaceX seems to, you know, encapsulate so many kind of big market themes at the moment. We've got the growth of private companies in private markets before they list. Questions about how indices are structured, increasingly active retail investors, especially in the US. Some quite questionable governance and even an AI angle with talk of data centers in space. What do you make of SpaceX and everything around
that? Well, it's a reflection of lots of things, isn't it? It's a reflection of the fact, as you rightly say, that you've got private companies that have become quite large. And by the way, that also used to happen in the past. It's not like it's new.
This isn't a new phenomenon.
This is, well, but it came as an IPO. Sometimes some of the very large companies just stayed out. Typically, we tend to see it in the more recent history in developing countries where the big players are not on the public market. Typically to avoid governance, by the way. That's generally speaking where that comes from.
Okay.
So it's an interesting one that we talked about. You talked about governance, I didn't. And about SpaceX, you can be sued. I'm not going to get sued.
That's fair enough.
But the only thing I'd say about SpaceX when it came out is it reflected the excitement of the market. So I believe it came to the market at 102 times sales when it IPO'd, I believe. And I'm not making a judgment on the company whether it's good or bad. I'm being purely neutral. But I'm saying I used to be a growth manager back in the days when I was employed as a fund manager. But I would say the 102 times sales, that takes the kind of faith you have when you walk into a church.
Okay, well, that's clear enough, I think. So you've rebranded to Federated Hermes at the start of the decade. And it's been about 5 years now since the parent took full control of Federated Hermes Limited, which is the international business you lead. What's gone well during that time and where do you still see room for improvement?
So it's an interesting one. And let me say this. We started talking together, the two firms, in 2012.
Wow.
We had the longest cultural courtship due diligence that you've ever seen. And what we noticed is if you talk to the CEO, Chris Donahue, he'd say to you that we understood that the culture almost converged or was the same. I'd say our values were the same. American culture is much more hierarchical than British culture. Our values were the same. And the really interesting thing was that when they bought us, they called the firm, they were still Hermes, and they were Federated Investors. One of the things that we do, which is unique, is we have a pledge. Nobody else in the industry has one, where every single employee signs a pledge. Go and look it up and read it. And it says things like, I will act ethically. It says things, I will put the interest of my client before the interest of the company. I will uphold fiduciary duty. I will work for the environment. I will advocate. I will work with others in the industry to make the world a better place. All hippie stuff that you would say about. But the really interesting thing is that Mr. Donahue, Chris Donahue, posted this on the Federated internal website. And he called me up a few months later and said, Sakhar, I've got 85% of my employees who have voluntarily signed this.
I see, the pledge that came from the Hermes.
So I think we should change the name of the company. Now, they were 550 billion of assets. We were 35 billion of assets in pounds. And we went to the New York Stock Exchange and we changed the name of the parent company to Federated Hermes Inc. Because the pledge makes sense. If you're an investor, that's exactly what you want your manager, your agent to do. You want them to act in your best interest. You want them to be long-term. You want them to put you at the heart of it. So what's gone well is we have integrated more and more over the time. And the integration is in two parts. The first one is we have spent a lot of money to integrate our investment capabilities so that we can share information. We're both active managers. Active management is all about informational advantage. By the way, also from stewardship, we've continued to develop our knowledge base in that space. We have something called financial connectivity, which we patent pending, which is a methodology that we take all the sustainability factors and the data that we have from doing 20 years of engagement, and we show how it connects to the P&L and balance sheet. And it also means that not only do the fund managers able to exchange information, we can bring products to the UK market that the old Hermes did not manage. So we become a franchise for all season.
Has that been going well? And that has cross-selling, been you might call it?
So yes, and that's been remarkably going very well. And all made, as I say, easier because we knew each other really well before we got married, so to speak. And the value system is very similar. We essentially want to do our duty, our fiduciary duty to our clients. We want to serve our clients. And we believe in long-term investing as being a way of doing it and to achieve active returns.
Okay. And where do you still see the room for improvement?
There's a lot to learn and there's a lot of talent to get. I mean, this is you learn every day. People don't spend enough time learning, by the way.
So from our audience of wealth managers, there's definitely renewed interest in emerging markets, which are a big part of your equity business. But it's been a bit of an odd time to be an active EM or Asian manager, with the index, you know, benchmarks driven by giant chip stocks, which almost no one is overweight. We've kind of discussed a bit of that already. But how do active managers deal with that?
So I think, again, you know, you've got to think through why is it that you want to have exposure to emerging markets? And I think there's two separate reasons for that. There's the non-cyclical reason, if you like, the long-term reason, which is that's where the growth is coming in terms of the growth of the economies, the growth of populations and the growth of wealth. That is on its way. I mean, look at the growth that's happened in China already.
Yeah.
Look at the growth that's happening in India and in Latin America and so on. And look at the development of technology. In the previous segment, we talked about an IPO for chip maker in China, which is, you know, trying to compete with the best of the chip makers in the United States. So that is, go back to the 19th century, that's the new world that America was, and that's where you sort of look to invest for long-term things. So that's one thing. But there's something else happening. And we've written about that. We did a paper called Three Tables of Roulette. If you go back to President Donald Trump's Liberation Day, and you think carefully, I know it's not on your question mark, but bear with me.
It's all right.
You think carefully about what he did. He wasn't talking about tariffs. What he was doing was he decided that the system that the United States built after 1945, with some help from the Brits, the system that's based on international law, on international organizations like the United Nations, on globalized trade according to rules, that system no longer serves the interests of the United States. And I think in his mind, he thought, why can't we go back to the mercantilist system of the 19th century, where we are the superpower like Britain was, and we can benefit from that? That's what he did, I think. And that's what we're seeing today. But when you do that, you then have an effect on the others. And one of the effects on the others, I think, it creates the world into segments. We've already seen that Europe thinks of itself or the liberal bloc as a segment. That was the Carney speech in Davos. And certainly the emerging markets start to see itself as a segment. And naturally, China is the dominant force within that. So within these three segments, you've got to think about how do I participate in the economy of each? Because each are different. So the long-term secular trend is that's where your growth is coming from in the emerging markets. But also separately, you're saying that these are now becoming more and more in not isolated, but economies that look after their own interests and that are working outside of the old globalized system. We're still within it, but beginning to work outside. And within that, there's really big opportunities. And that's what you try to get into. And that's why emerging markets remains long-term, I think, the natural place to be. Go back to the 19th century, read about the bond markets. It was that's how things were financed back then,
okay.
Run by the Rothschilds. And where do you think they put the money? They put the money in the emerging markets of the United States and Latin America.
Yeah.
Same thing.
You mentioned those different blocks. I mean, even in emerging markets, there's a trend of maybe people looking at China separately. I mean, yeah, I suppose the changes you're talking about, that how does that change the goal of an emerging market manager specifically? How do they have a better chance of, you know, beating the benchmark?
So we talked at the beginning of the segment about my background. I started the Mercury Asset Management, which was the premier British fundamental fund manager of its day. Get to know the stocks and buy stocks, not the market beater. It's very hard. It means there'll be years sometimes when you underperform.
Yeah.
That's clear. But over the long term, you create value because ultimately that's how value is created in markets. If you think we go back about SpaceX, SpaceX IPO, the people who bought it at the IPO made some money. But I was in a meeting of something called the 300 Club, which is a club of the CIOs of some of the major pension schemes in the world, which we are part of. And they were saying that one of them was saying that they bought into SpaceX way before the IPO. Now, that made them a huge amount of money, right? So it's knowing the stock that you go into and when you go into it, whether it's in the private side or the public side, and how you do it, rather than trying to just play the beta of the market.
Okay. Well, that does bring us nicely on to private markets, which would be good to speak about a bit. You know, you do have a business there. I mean, what are your ambitions there? And do you want to make more acquisitions to build that up?
So we do want to grow it. We think it's, and we have been growing it. Let me just say two things about it. The first one is people think private markets is separate from public markets. I find this all the time. ESG is separate from the markets. Public markets separate from private markets. No, it's the same thing. It's the economy. It's just one is mark to market, or the valuations mark to market on a daily basis. And the other one is every whatever time period it is.
Yeah.
But ultimately, it's a different way to gain exposure to economic growth. That's all that it is. It's an instrument to do so. It allows you more control by and large.
A central way?
Yes. And it allows you more control in some ways because you sit on the board. So all the engagement that we do for public markets through our EOS business, actually you do naturally in a private equity fund or in a property fund and so on. So we think it's a good space to be. And we've recently made acquisitions in the United Kingdom. We made an acquisition of Revington. That's a circular economy and alternative energy play, and one of the lead players within that fits well within our MEPC, our developer that develops places. We talked before about the development of King's Cross as a place that fits together. How do you do that? We bought FCP in the United States, which is looks for living space. And then I say there's a whole segment of the community where they rent rather than buy. And again, creates place by building, developing, improving living space. And we will continue to look at this area to expand because you want to have...
It sounds like real estate or kind of interesting real asset opportunities.
So it's a real asset opportunity, but we might buy something else. We developed an in-house direct lending business some years ago. We continue to expand that and expand where we go within that. We're interested in, you know, again, if you speak to Chris Dunne, who's the CEO of the whole business, he'll say to you that we've built it to be a franchise for all seasons, which also allows us, and this is important, if you have it's not just being able to give the clients a whole bunch of things that they need at all times, but also to have the resilience so that you always have a business that's going so you can continue to invest, which goes back to the previous point. So we continue to learn and improve, because the more we learn and improve, the more that we can give back to our clients.
And are you finding there's genuine a big push in the industry is to sell these products now to different audiences, you know, to wealth managers and their clients, or even directly to retail? Are you finding there's genuine demand there from those audiences?
So certainly there is a move and appears to be demand, particularly from very high net worth individuals, and that's been established. We know that the family offices have been investing in it for a long time, so it's natural to move down to very high net worth individuals and then to high net worth individuals. Now, we have to always keep in mind these are illiquid assets. And if it does get pushed into the retail space, even if it's the very top end of the retail space, you have to make sure that those people who get exposure to it understand what illiquid means. It means you can't get out.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, people assume, oh, yes, well, I can at a discount. Sometimes you can't until the time comes. But there's a quid pro quo. In return for that, you get extraordinary returns. But the two have to go together. So it's a matter of, can you structure it in such a way that people really understand? And that's why it tends to concentrate right now in the very high net worth, where they have a much wider dispersion of investments, and therefore they can afford to have something as purely liquid. But people are working on it, and there certainly seems to be demand. In the United States, we've certainly seen the advisors come with demand for it.
Okay, but a bit slower in Europe?
Slightly slower in Europe. It's there, but slightly slower.
All right. There's been this rise in asset management of solutions as opposed to selling single strategies. You're kind of selling an entire investment proposition. How is Federated Hermes meeting that in the UK and Europe?
So let me tell you a story. So in the summer of 1986, I start interviewing for a job in the city because I can't find a job as an academic. I'm in my corduroy suit and I have no knowledge of what investment management is. And eventually, Mercrest Management takes pity on me. And Oldfield, partly because, whatever reason, takes pity and hires me.
This is Richard Oldfield, who went on to found his own firm.
Yeah. Well, he's a wonderful man, truly wonderful. Actually, the firm was extraordinary, led by Carol Galley, Stephen Zimmerman, David Rosier led the private client division. Extraordinary people, actually, way ahead of their time. But here is the story. When I, you know, so stupid little me, no knowledge of Mark, said, what is it that we do? They said, well, it's very simple. Pension schemes give us their money, and we try to grow it above inflation. And we do that by investing in lots of different types of investments. So we have emerging markets, UK, European markets, US markets, bond markets, and so on. And then over the years, somehow that's broken down where we start saying, well, we're not going to do that. We're not going to give you a single portfolio. We're going to break it down into you buy emerging markets from us, or maybe you buy direct lending from us, or maybe you buy real estate from us. And it looks like we're going right back to where we were in 1987. We actually give us the money and we give you a return. It's just...
Do you think that's better?
Or? I personally think it's a better way of doing it, yes.
Okay. And are you having success selling
so
that
kind of thing? So we are thinking of how we can present that. Again, in the United States, it's less in demand than it is here. And
oh, really?
It tends to be more in demand for pension schemes and larger players. But it's something we look at, and I'm sure we will build on it as we go along.
Okay. With big advice firms or those kinds of people?
So we're looking at how we can can grow that.
Okay. So, you know, you've mentioned managing pension money. There's a big conversation around whether too little pension money in the UK is invested in UK equities. It used to be a lot. Now it's in the low single digits. And some people seem to think reversing that trend would have huge benefits for the UK stock market, but also the UK economy. What do you think?
So I think, in a sense, we're asking you and I the wrong question, because I have that question asked a lot. And, and the right question is, do we have enough pension money in the UK? And the answer is no, because one of the inadvertent results of the Maxwell legislation following the Maxwell scandal, that's the father, not the daughter, who stole money from the pensioners, was that it made pension rules so onerous that we killed the DB pension scheme. By killing the DB pension scheme, we killed these large blocks of investments for ordinary investors, which used to invest in property and private markets and the UK market. And we've distributed, or we've outsourced people's retirement, care of people's retirement and savings to individuals who then use advisors. That is partly why there's so little investment in the UK. Not entirely, because once you fragmented, go back to the question you just asked a minute before, you start buying how much I have emerging market versus how much I, and then when I'm not thinking, what's my home market bias, what's my currency bias. So I think that's one of the reasons that there's not enough investment. And we're not thinking enough about how we benefit the ecosystem we live in. So I do think that, yes, if we had more concentrated pension funds putting slightly more money in private markets in the UK and also in stocks, small cap stocks, we have some excellent companies here, it would benefit because we live here.
Yeah. I mean,
if we build the system here, this is where I'm going to retire.
Hopefully. And there are moves towards that in a small way. I mean, do you think some of that should be more mandated, though? Because people do get big tax breaks for investing in a pension.
Yes, and I think that's a whole different topic that I'm very passionate about. And I think we should have a different system for pensions here. And we can't go back to the old DB system. That's dead and gone. But we can look at models. The Australian model, to my mind, is the best of both worlds. You have a mandated percentage of your income that you have to save.
It's 12%, I think.
Yes, and they're going to increase it. And you save it in these units, in these superannuation funds that essentially act with the expertise of an old DB fund, if you like, or the old Mercury. So you can buy in block, you can invest, but you can choose which one you go to. I'm not saying let's have that, but it's a good system to look at. It's fairer to the investor because you can have buying power, you can have investment capability power, you can have thought power, you can have long-term duration, which is what we talked about a lot. It's better for the country, and I think there's a better outcome.
Okay. Last question from me today, Saka. You've been CEO since 2011, and we've mentioned that there was this big merger. Are you starting to think about succession planning?
So we always think about succession planning, not just simply because I might step down, but because I ride a motorcycle and I might be hit by a car. Actually, I stopped riding for the last 2 years because my wife wouldn't let me, or I take the underground and you never know what happens on the tube or whatever. So we always think about succession planning. If you ask me, are you thinking of retiring? The answer is not just yet. One of the interesting things about American culture versus British culture is that people work much later into American companies than they do in British corporations. As long as I can be of service to my clients, to my stakeholders, to my employees, ultimately, to the community that I live in, as long as I think I'm contributing something to the whole debate about sustainability and so on, I'm enjoying being here and so on. If I drop dead tomorrow, I drop dead tomorrow. It doesn't really matter. But the idea, I don't play golf. So I can't see myself sort of going off to the sunset to playing golf. I don't play cards. I don't watch football. I'm very boring, really.
You just think about riding motorcycles
again. I just think about riding motorcycles again. So for the time being, I'm not going to do, a long motorcycle ride and I'm here. But there is a succession plan in place.
Well, that seems a good note to finish on. Thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Apollo 11 has
tearing down the Berlin Wall.
Since 1929, the Monks Investment Trust's mission has been to help investors grow their wealth. We aim to do this today by taking a three-dimensional approach to growth. Cyclical growth, rapid growth, and steady growth.
The World Wide Web.
Wall Street is in turmoil as stocks crash.
The Monks Investment Trust, managed by Bailey Gifford. Capital at risk.